specify everything that's happening, the real state of affairs, in this region of the backward light cone, that should completely fix what's going on in this region. And he called that local determinism, because you're imagining that things here are, in fact, deterministically fixed by what's going on here, but they're not deterministic. You don't need a specification of what's going on outside the backward light cone, and so in that sense, it's relativistically local. So this is a fine notion of locality, but Bell was also interested in being able to say something about locality for theories that might not be deterministic. And then this won't work, because if you don't have determinism in your theory, then it wouldn't be true that you could completely specify what the beables here are by specifying what they are here. So to deal with that case, he introduced another notion of locality, and this is sort of the standard one in the literature. So when people talk about Bell's theorem showing that locality fails, they're talking about local causality, okay? So again, this is a quote from one of Bell's papers. A theory will be said to be locally causal if the probabilities for the values of local beables in space-time region A. So he's not talking about dependences of the values of the variable in this region anymore. He's talking about what the probabilities of the values of this of these variables depend on. So that's the shift. So if the probabilities for the values of local beables in space-time region A are unaltered by specification of values of local beables in space-time region B, when what happens in the backward light cone of A is already sufficiently specified, for example, by a full specification of local beables in space-time region C. So here, A and B are space-like separated. C is a region that closes off the backward light cone of A. And the idea is that if you specify the probabilities of A given a complete specification of what's going on in C, and then you further condition on stuff that's going on over here, you won't update your probabilities. So it may be that what happens here is not completely determined by what's here, but however you can narrow down the probabilities for A here, you're not going to get any further narrowing down by specifying what's happening over here. Specifying what's happening here is already the best you can do in terms of making predictions for region A. Of course, the reason it's stated in this way is that if you hadn't conditioned on things going on here and you just said, can I update my probabilities for A by conditioning on B, the answer might have been sure, because they're correlated. And so learning something about this teaches you something about this. But the point is that once you know everything about C, it screens off B. So B does not have any more information about A than C has. And that's why your probabilities about A won't update if you've already conditioned on C. That's local causality. Is it clear? Well, we'll see it in action. Maybe if it's not clear, let me know and I can go over it again. This is one way of formalizing it. So we just, if XA is an event in region A and XB is some event in region B, then I say the probability that's assigned to XA, given a specification of the event in B, and given a sufficient specification of what's happening in this region, C, so I'll call that lambda C, is the same as the probability of the event in A, just given that specification in C. So conditioning on the events in B don't lead to an update of the probabilities on A. Okay, so this is the, let's apply this in the Bell theorem scenario. So remember, what we had was a pair of particles that were generated here at some point. They fly off to different wings. There's a choice of setting over here on the left, and then there's an outcome. Okay, so last time we were talking about settings as S and T and outcomes as red and green, but a more standard terminology is like, is little a and little b will specify the parameters, the settings, and capital A and capital B specify the outcomes, what I've done here. So I'm going to move to that more conventional notation now. And there are some hidden variables which are accessible at both wings, right? So remember when we did our game last time, both players knew exactly what the strategy was. And so they both sort of had a copy of the local instruction set that each of them was using. So you may as well imagine that, you know, all the values of the hidden variables that go here are also known over here. So I can just specify that these hidden values of the hidden variables are sort of known on both sides of the space-time diagram. Okay, so what does local causality imply in this case? Suppose I'm interested in the probabilities for different outcomes A over here. In general, I might want to condition on everything else in the problem. So the setting on the left, the setting on the right, the outcome on the right, and the values of the hidden variables, the ontic state. But local causality says that little b and big B are over here in a space like separated region from A. And it says that if lambda, the hidden variables, are already a sufficient specification, so as long as I include enough stuff in here, then that'll be sufficient for predicting the outcomes of this measurement. And further conditioning on these guys aren't going to give me any more information. If they did, it would say that somehow there must be an influence from here to here, and that's what we want to rule out. We want to say that any correlations between these guys is due to the hidden variables. And therefore, if I've already conditioned on the hidden variables, then that gives me all the predictability about the outcomes on the left that I can hope for. Okay, you get a similar condition about the outcomes on the right. It's just the symmetric condition. So the outcomes on the right should not depend on the setting or the outcome on the left. It should only depend on the setting on the right and the hidden variables. And it turns out that this pair of condition implies another condition, which is known as factorizability. So this is just another way of writing what the content of local causality is. And it says that if I look at the probability of A and B, that is what has the information about the correlations, right? So we want to know, what's the probability of agreement for a given pair of settings? What's the probability of disagreement for a given pair of settings? That's this kind of expression, the probability for the outcomes given the settings. And what it says is that it factorizes. So the probability of A and B is just the probability of outcome A given the setting at A and the hidden variables times the probability B given the setting at B given the hidden variables. So what it says is that there is no correlation between the outcomes if you condition on the hidden variables, right? So that's what you want when you have a causal explanation, that the correlations should be due to your ignorance of what's really going on. But once you've fully specified what fixes those outcomes, the correlation is gone, right? So if you know enough about lambda, then learning about the outcome at A teaches you nothing about B, because you already know lambda, and lambda is sufficient to specify is your best specification of what the probabilities for different outcomes at A and B are. So let me show you why this implies this. So first of all, you have to remember a bit of probability theory. So what's the relationship between joint and conditional probabilities? It's just this. The joint probability of A and B is the conditional probability A given B times the probability of B. That's just the definition of what a conditional probability is. But I can also further condition on other variables. Like I could condition the whole equation on C. Like, you know, if there's some background information that I'm not bothering to specify, well, this equation will still hold. But if I write it out explicitly, it says that the probability of A and B given C is the probability of A given BC and the probability of B given C. So all I've done is just put a C on the right of the conditional in this equation. It still holds. Okay, so let me apply that. So if I take this quantity I'm interested in, the correlations between the outcomes given the settings and the hidden variables, well, because of this fact about probability theory, I can always write it this way. So it's the probability of the outcome on the left given everything else times the probability of the outcome on the right given A, B, lambda. So if you just think of A, B, lambda as C in this equation, I've just rewritten it here. Okay, so A, B, and lambda are just this background information. So I've made no claims about the nature of the correlations by doing this. I've just rewritten the probability. So there's no content to this equation. It's just a true equation of probability theory. So now I start applying the assumption of local causality to simplify these terms. So this guy here, by local causality, can simplify to this. So this is the outcome on the left shouldn't depend on the setting on the right or the outcome on the right. And similarly here, the outcome on the right should not depend on the setting on the left. So it simplifies to that. And so I plug those in, and I get this factorizability condition I showed you. So local causality implies factorizability. And then finally, to derive Bell inequalities, you need to make one further assumption, which we talked a bit about last time, which is that the probability distribution over the settings and the hidden variables are all independent. So for example, the experimenters on both wings are free to choose the setting in any way they like. The hidden variables and the particles don't depend on what settings have been chosen. The settings don't depend on those hidden variables. So we talked about superdeterminism as a way out. This is an assumption that there is not superdeterminism. There is no correlation between the settings and the hidden variables. Okay. So using all that, you can derive this Bell inequality I talked about last time. So here we have, two choices of settings on the left, which I call little a and little a prime, two choices of settings on the right, little b and little b prime, and two outcomes for each. Yes?
And about that superdeterminism.
Yes?
Can they, for example, each of these apparatus look, for example, at a far star in their own direction, and for example, if they see some sign or something, then they decide to, put it in the x direction or z direction. They decide in a way that doesn't, the information about the direction which they're going to measure, it's not yet at the point B. So, or there is no way they could be accessible there in any kind of, it's because it's, there is no, there is no way that in the, okay, yeah, there might be, if you consider some kind of big bang thing, then they might be correlated, but,
Maybe you can tell me, what's the point you're trying to make? That we shouldn't assume this, that we should assume this? I'm not clear.
What I'm trying to say is, can we make, what we talked about in the previous lecture was like, if all of the things, this apparatus and things like that, they're all in a set, for example, in some times ago, then
right.
They...
Right, they're like determinist, they're predetermined by something in the distant past. Yeah.
So now everything is determined.
Right, and so this would fail because... I'm just wondering if there's some way that this could hold even though they're all predetermined and correlated with one another. I don't see exactly how you could have that. Let me think some more about it and get back to you.
Okay.
Let me put it this way. Certainly, if this were to fail, then you'd have a way of generating violations of Bell inequalities, kinds of correlations we saw yesterday, while still maintaining locality. Because the settings, for example, on the left, on the right, might not have been chosen at random. They might actually be correlated. And then particles could have a strategy that would win those sorts of games. So you certainly need this to derive the Bell inequalities, to show that something strange is going on. There may still be ways of out, ways to salvage a locality, even if this assumption holds. But certainly if it doesn't hold, then you have some problems. Right, so one of the things you're gonna do in the tutorial is sort of finish up the last steps of the proof. So I've sort of gotten you from Bell's technical notion of local causality to factorizability. And then there's sort of one extra step where you go from factorizability to the proof of this inequality, which last time we sort of saw the intuitive version of why it should be bounded above by 3/4. And in the tutorial, you'll just go through the math. And what I just want to mention here is that there's another way of expressing this same Bell inequality. This is actually the way you'll see it expressed more often. in terms of correlations. So you define a correlation between the outcomes for setting little a on the left and the outcomes for setting little b on the right. And it's basically something whose value tells you whether they tend to agree or tend to disagree. So it's plus 1 times the probability of agreement plus minus 1 times the probability of disagreement. So for example, if they always agree, this is plus 1. If they always disagree, it's minus 1. And then in terms of those correlation functions, if I take the sum for these settings, AB, A prime B, AB prime, and I subtract off the correlation for A prime B prime, then you can show that this thing here is less than or equal to 2, and quantum mechanics achieves 2 root 2. So remember here, quantum mechanics achieved 0.85 about, which is a half plus 1 over 2 root 2. So the analogous violation is 2 root 2. And this is called the Clauser-Horn-Shimoni-Holt inequality. So I just wanted to show you, I mean, maybe you saw this form of it in Adrian's course? Maybe not? Nope. Okay. It's just if you're reading the literature, you'll see a lot of expressions like this one rather than this one. But it has the same content. And you'll also go from here to here in the tutorial. Okay. You can read about it in Bell's book as well. Good. So let me just pause to talk about two notions of locality that you might think would capture the sense in which special relativity implies that our world should be local. So the first notion of locality is this notion of local causality due to Bell. I've just rewritten up here. And the other one is the constraint of no superluminal signaling. So in this particular context where we have these two measurements on the left wing and the right wing, and outcomes capital A and capital B, what it says is that the probability distribution of the outcomes on the left, given the setting on the left and the setting on the right, actually doesn't depend on the setting on the right at all. So as you change the setting on the right, the probability distributions over outcomes on the left don't change. If they did change, then you could use it to signal, right? So Alice over on wing A would agree with Bob ahead of time. Okay, we're gonna do a 1,000 runs of the experiment, and if I want to send you a 0, I will set my device to setting 1, and we'll take 1,000 bits of data, look at the statistics, and you'll be able to see that I'm sending you a 0 if the statistics are 1 kind of thing. If I'm sending you 1, the statistics will be a little bit different, and you'll be able to distinguish those, and so we can communicate basically instantaneously. So you want this to be true for no signaling to hold, and similarly, you don't want signaling from the A wing to the B wing. And so the question is, does the notion of local causality capture the content of relativity theory, or would it be better to say that it's just the no signaling principle that captures that content? What do you think?
Local causality.
Okay, why?
You wouldn't deduce it either way, otherwise.
I'm not saying there's a definite answer to this question. It's people will differ on how they feel about this. I just want to discuss it. So why do you think local causality does more justice to the principle of locality or to relativity theory than no signaling?
No, it kind of, no signaling doesn't talk anything about light cones. I mean, it kind of talks about space-time separation, but that's all. Space-time separation, but that's all. I mean, whereas the local causality somehow gives you, I mean, it assumes some extra determinism in the theory that seems required for causality to fall.
So I'm going to disagree with you on both points. So local causality was supposed to get rid of the notion of determinism. That was so I started with local determinism, where the outcomes in some region or the events in some region depend on the region in the backward light cone. Local causality is meant to say even if there's objective indeterminism, this captures the notion of locality. So it doesn't assume determinism.
It assumes hidden variables, which kind of give you more determinism.
Well, in the context we're applying it, it refers to the hidden variables, but not necessarily, right? So the lambdas let's say you think that the quantum state is a complete description of reality. Let me go back to my figure. The quantum state is the only thing you can say. So if you want a complete description of the ontic state lambda, it's just going to be the quantum state. Say that was your point of view, then you could still apply the notion of local causality. You could say instead of lambda here, you could say the quantum state psi. This would have to be true with lambda replaced by psi. So Bell's notion of local causality actually is something that applies to any theory. So I've got my landscape of possible theories, quantum theory is one of them, classical theory is another. In any theory, you can ask, does it satisfy Bell's notion of local causality or not? Because it just asks you to say, well, what does the theory specify a complete description of reality looks like? And then ask whether outcomes of measurements depend on that complete description of reality in these sorts of ways. So I think this notion of locality does manage to not assume determinism, not assume that you have to have hidden variables in the picture, does assume a realist interpretation, that you're specifying the theory as a kind of realist model of what's going on. And then the second thing I want to say is that I think both notions, no signaling, local causality, both appeal to space-like separation to the same extent, right? So here, you know, A and B are just said to be space-like separated. I mean, strictly speaking, I don't need a light cone structure. I just need some sort of cone structure. I need a notion of a limit on speed of propagation. And then I'll be able to talk about things that are space-like separated with respect to that limiting velocity in both cases. Where are we? So other thoughts on... I mean, what's at stake is if you think that this somehow better captures the notion of locality and relativity, then you might say there is no tension between quantum mechanics and relativity. So that would be a motivation for just going with no signaling as the notion of locality and relativity.
Yes. If you're a realist, you should use the best one.
Yeah. The no signaling principle, one way to think about it is that the stuff that's on the right of the conditional here have to be things that you can control. So Alice has to be able to change her settings in order to send a signal. So we always have to talk about controllable macroscopic variables over here. And the things on the left of the conditional has to be observable changes so that Bob can read out the signal. So these have to be variables that an operationalist would refer to, you know, things that we can read out at a macroscopic level. Whereas up here, if we look at the general definition of local causality, neither the stuff on the left or the right of the conditional has to be macroscopic or operational. It could all be just the actual values of variables, physical variables. And applying it in the particular case to the Bell setup, it still maintains reference to these lambdas, which aren't things that are operationally accessible. So Bell himself argued in favor of this notion on the following grounds. So he was a realist, remember. And he said, look, our best fundamental microscopic theory, if we ask, what's its content, it would be very odd if the answer came out that it depends on a notion of observer and a notion of what's controllable and what's observable. All those kinds of notions just don't belong in the language of a fundamental microscopic theory of physics. Just like the language of measurements and preparations didn't belong in the axioms, according to a realist. They should be described in something more fundamental. Similarly here, controllable and observable and the whole notion of sending signals and sending messages, those are not notions that are appropriate for a fundamental physical theory. The notion of the probabilities of events given other events in other areas of space-time, those kinds of notions are appropriate. And that's what local causality refers to. So if you want a notion of locality that refers only to that sort of stuff, then you're likely to land here, not here. So that was Bell's argument. And so it's essentially Bell's response to people who say that there is no tension between relativity and quantum mechanics. Some people do say that on the grounds that, you know, this is all the locality that relativity predicts. And Bell says, well, if you're a realist, that's just not a satisfying notion of locality. And so Bell claims there really is a tension here. Okay, so last time somebody asked me a question about predictability, so I inserted this slide into the talk. I just want to give you a short proof of something interesting that comes out of Bell's theorem, which is that if you have Bell inequality violations and yet no superluminal signals in your theory, so quantum theory is an example of such a theory, it follows that there will be events that are unpredictable in the sense that you can't know everything about them. Okay, so you can't have perfect predictability about those events. So one way to say that is, you know, you have a kind of uncertainty principle. You can't know everything. So the way the argument works, there's actually this idea, this result has been discovered over and over again in the last few years by many different people. This list is probably incomplete. But the idea is very simple. It says, suppose you have a notion of predictability of the following sort. So again, we have our measurements. These are the settings, these are the outcomes. Suppose it's possible to learn some stuff such that you can predict the outcomes of those measurements with certainty. So these probabilities become 0 or 1, okay? If you can do that, then we'll say that we have predictability in the theory, or you might have called this perfect predictability, that it's possible to learn something such that you would know exactly what outcome a measurement would have. So we've been talking about this idea that, you know, maybe in the future, if, you know, quantum mechanics were found to fail, maybe we could have a theory where the outcomes of experiments wouldn't be unknown. They could be perfectly predictable. So it's not unreasonable to imagine a theory of that sort. But suppose now that your theory has this no signaling property, which we saw on the last slide, both from left to right and from right to left, then you can prove the following theorem, that if you have no signaling and you have a violation of Bell inequalities, then you must have a failure of predictability. Not all measurements could have their outcomes predicted with certainty. So the proof proceeds by showing the contrapositive of this. So assume no signaling. If you can show that predictability implies no Bell inequality violations, then you will have established this result, right? So, you know, if you have if X then Y, that's the same as if not Y then not X. So here's how the proof works. First, given that you're assuming things are perfectly predictable, conditioning on some extra variables here, so maybe some hidden variables, lambda, isn't going to make A and B any more predictable because I've already assigned values 0 or 1 to this probability. So further conditioning is not going to change that probability. There's nowhere for it to go. You know, getting more information once I already know something with certainty doesn't lead to any update. So the probabilities of the outcomes will depend just on the settings and any other background information I might have about the preparation procedure, for example. But this guy here, I can immediately write as a product of probabilities, again, because it has values 0 or 1. So think about it this way. Capital A and capital B are functions of little a and little b. And so I can obviously write that just as, you know, this probability is 0 or 1, so I can write it as the product of these probabilities. Or maybe another way to put it is that, you know, if I wrote down this probability as a delta function, delta function between capital A and some function f of A and B, and it's a delta function for capital B and some function g of A and B, then I could just write it as the product of those delta functions. Okay, and then finally I apply no signaling, and that tells me that the outcome on the left can't depend on the setting on the right, so it reduces to this. Here it tells me the outcome on the right can't depend on the setting on the left, so it reduces to that. And now I have factorizability, right? I've factorized the joint probability of A and B into two terms. And that was the starting point for deriving the Bell inequality. So from this point on, you can derive the Bell inequality. So it says that any correlations you see in your experiments will respect the Bell inequalities. So I've shown that predictability and no signaling implies satisfaction of the Bell inequalities. Therefore, if you observe that the Bell inequalities aren't satisfied, something has to give. And if you assume that no singling continues to hold, then it's predictability that has to give. So one way to think about this is that, you know, you've got these funny correlations, Bell correlations, and the reason it didn't lead to superluminal signaling was because you had some ignorance about what the hidden variables were. But if you sort of lift that and say, suppose I can know the hidden variables, then you could use that knowledge and those strong correlations to send signals. And so if you assume that you can't send signals, then you're forced to an epistemic restriction. So this is one way you could try to motivate the starting point of those psi epistemic models we talked about a few days ago, where we said, well, suppose you can't know everything. Well, in a world where you have Bell inequality violations and no signaling, you definitely can't know everything according to this theorem. So that might be one way of justifying that sort of starting point. Good. Questions about that? All right. So I wanted to, before moving on to talk about contextuality, I want to say a few words about the applications of non-locality. So again, this is something that we've seen only in recent years. It used to be that Bell's theorem was of interest mostly to people working on foundations, you know, and it had significance for how we should think about the way the world works. But since the rise of quantum information, people have started realizing that it's a resource. Being able to prepare systems and do measurements that violate Bell inequalities can be used for information processing tasks. And so there's a list of these now. And when I was trying to, I was giving a talk about this once, and I wanted a kind of dramatic way of talking about how interesting these sorts of applications were. Because these Bell inequality violations are sort of arcane phenomena. You know, they're hard to think about, they're not intuitive. And so it's really surprising to see practical things coming out of them. And it's very hard to devise new protocols to basically help with practical tasks. So it's a little bit magical. And so I thought, well, maybe I could find a definition on the web of magic that would kind of fit with Bell inequality violations. And so I'm sad to say the definition that worked best was from the Harry Potter Wikipedia page, which, if you've never visited, I swear I never had, gives you this definition of magic. Magic is a natural force that can be used to override the usual laws of nature. So that fits nicely, because what you could say is that Bell inequality violations are a natural phenomena that can be used to override the usual, meaning classical-like, laws of nature. So I quite like that. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. And then, just as, you know, the point of magic is to have some interesting spells, one of the points of Bell inequality violations is to have some interesting tricks you can do with them. So let me give you a few examples of some quantum spellcraft. Here they are. So one of them is reductions in communication complexity. So this is a computational problem where Alice has some data, Bob has some data. They want to compute some function that depends on both their data, and they want to minimize the amount of information they have to send back and forth to do it. It turns out if you have access to Bell inequality violations, you can reduce the amount of communication you need to compute certain functions. Another example is, let me go here, randomness expansion. So if I just showed you that nice example where you could prove that there's genuine unpredictability if you have Bell inequality violations and no signaling, people have argued that you can use that sort of effect to have certified randomness, something where you know that your adversary can't possibly predict what the outcomes are. It's genuinely random as long as the world really is no signaling, right? So that's your security assumptions are very weak. You're saying, you know, the physical theory could be anything. As long as it's no signaling, as long as I violate Bell inequalities, I've got security. This one here is about doing secure key distribution. So people talk about this in quantum information a lot. It's sort of setting up two parties who want to communicate in private with a secret key that they can do their encodings with. And quantum mechanics gives you a way of distributing keys such that an eavesdropper can't, although the eavesdropper might stop you from distributing the key, you'll never end up in a situation where the eavesdropper has a copy of the key. You can sort of protect yourself from the eavesdropper, know that they have no information. So again, what you can show is that by assuming simply that the world you're living in does not allow superluminal signaling and there are no Bell inequality violations, you can devise a protocol where you can be sure at the end, Alice and Bob can be sure at the end that they have a key that the eavesdropper doesn't have a copy of. And what's really amazing is that because they're just looking at the correlations in their data and looking at certain features of them, it turns out that the eavesdropper, the adversary, could even provide their devices. So the eavesdropper, your enemy, says, you know, here's your measurement devices. And you say, well, I don't trust this person. But nonetheless, if I do my measurements at space-like separation and I verify that there are Bell inequality violations, you can prove that the eavesdropper must have no information about the key that you generate. So these are really strong forms of security. And then finally, there's this example from just a few years ago, which it really blew my mind. It was something that I had never expected could be done. But again, with Bell inequality violations, you can enhance how much classical information you can send down a channel with no error. So the recipient gets that classical information with no error. Good, so let me just say one thing about how the secure key distribution works, just to give you an intuition for it. I think this is useful. Sort of supplements the other thing about the unpredictability. So suppose you have Alice and Bob who have these very strong correlations where it's agreement. So they have each two measurements that they might do, and each measurement has two possible outcomes. And the correlations are such that if they both do these, then they are correlated. If they do any of the diagonal pairs, then they also get correlation. But if they do these two, they get anti-correlation. That's what the dashed line means. So suppose that rather than a quantum world, they're living in a world where they can get those correlations with probability one, just to make the discussion simple. But they're worried about the possibility that their adversary might also be able to share those correlations with Alice. So maybe the adversary coupled in a system with the system that Alice sent to Bob to set up these correlations and sort of carried away some information about it. And now the adversary is going to have exactly the same is going to be able to have exactly the same correlations with Alice as Bob does. So that would be bad because if Alice and Bob are going to start doing measurements and use those measurement outcomes to define their key, then the adversary could also do some measurements and have information about that key. So you would like it so that these kinds of correlations can't be shared in this way. And it turns out that because of no signaling, they can't be shared in this way. So that's what I need to prove to you, that this, if this were possible, then it would also be possible to signal faster than the speed of light. So here's why. Suppose Alice and these guys are space-like separated, okay? And now imagine for a moment that they're cooperating, right? Because if Bob and the adversary could share these correlations, then Bob and a friend of Bob's could also have these kinds of correlations. So they could get together and compare their results. And if Alice does this measurement here, okay? Is that what I want? Yes, if Alice does this measurement and Bob does, forget the measurement Alice is doing. Suppose Bob does the first measurement here, and the other party does the second measurement. Okay, so now if Alice does the first measurement, her outcome is correlated with both Bob and the adversary's outcome, because these are both straight lines. So if Alice does this measurement, they will see that their outcomes are correlated. But if Alice does the other measurement, then it's anti-correlated with this guy's outcome and correlated with that guy's outcome. So their outcomes will be anti-correlated. So all they have to do is get together and look at whether their outcomes are correlated or anti-correlated, and they'll know whether Alice did this measurement or that measurement. And so that means that Alice could use that to signal to them faster than the speed of light. So people call this limitation on how much you can share correlations monogamy. So these kinds of correlations are monogamous. You can only have these correlations with one other person. So Alice and Bob have monogamous Bell inequality violating correlations. They can't be shared with another party. And this is the sort of reason that you can do this secure key distribution. You can be sure that your adversary doesn't have information by building on this sort of fact. Okay. Finally, let me just note that we have this 85% violation of Bell inequalities. I just said that badly. The Bell inequality is 75%. We achieve correlations, we can win that game with probability 85%. A question that people are asking these days is, why can't we do it better? So in addition to asking why do we have non-locality at all, it's interesting to ask why don't we have more? And this has actually led to some interesting ideas recently, trying to pinpoint exactly that amount of non-locality we see in quantum theory. Okay, so let me pause for any last questions about Bell's theorem.
Well, that no error thing, what's it about? I mean, what does it mean, no error?
The error-free channel capacity result? It's a case where often in communication protocols, we want people to have, you know, a high probability of getting the message out correctly. So I put in a message, you're going to read it out. You want to bound the probability that you get the wrong answer. But there's another approach wherein you say you want to have zero error. So you never want to be to guess that I sent message one when in fact I sent message two. So you can ask how many messages can be sent down a noisy channel in such a way that you can get my message with zero error. And so it's typically much harder to do a zero error transmission down a noisy channel.
Does it suppose anything special about the noise, or is it just...
Yeah, so the channels for which you get an enhanced capacity are very particular, channels that have a very particular kind of noise. A lot of these applications are sort of catered. They're not sort of the natural thing that you thought was the natural problem that you thought was interesting to solve, but rather a problem for which Bell correlations provide an advantage, however unnatural that problem is. Key distribution is certainly a natural problem, so I wouldn't say that about this case. But others, for the time being, might seem a little bit unnatural, but you do get an advantage. Yes?
Okay, so if you wanted to distribute information that can't be spied on.
Yeah.
So if the person can't just tap into the line, but what if they sat in between the two
mm-hmm.
communicators? And so Alice would transmit her information.
Right.
She'd get that it was sent, and then the spy would pass it along. But would that not work because you have 85% times 85% at best? Or
actually, I think what you're describing is called a man-in-the-middle attack. So the eavesdropper could pretend to be Bob to Alice and pretend to be Alice to Bob and just run two separate protocols. You know, so she's sort of, you know, just kind of standing in for each of them. And so each of them thinks that they're dealing with the other, but in fact they're both dealing with Eve. And so she just runs the protocol for both of them and sets up shared keys with both of them. So technically the way you get around that sort of problem, the way you evade that sort of attack, is what's called an authentication protocol. So you sort of start off by Alice making sure that she's really talking to Bob. And the way they do that is by sharing some prior key. So Alice,
so there's no quantum solution to the man in the middle?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. My understanding is that the classical authentication protocols work fine. You know, you just start out with a key and you can make sure you're talking to the right person. But then, strictly speaking, what these protocols do is not generate key, but expand key, because you needed a seed of key to start with to do your authentication. So it's more accurate, I'd say that these are key expansion protocols. I'm not an expert on that authentication part of that, but it's, yeah, I think it's an interesting question whether you could do a quantum version of authentication. I'm pretty sure there are some papers, no?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you can.
You can't do quantum authentication.
You have to have the password. So. For the man in the middle attack, I mean, it's probably important to point out that Eve can have complete access to the quantum channel in QPD. It's if she's doing a man in the middle attack on the classical channel that it's a problem. The assumption is she can do whatever she wants to the quantum channel.
So maybe I'm not talking about man in the middle attack when I say Eve pretends to be Bob and pretends towards Alice and pretends to be Alice towards Bob. Maybe that's not what they call that attack. Is that sort of attack?
No, that's
they do?
Right. That's
that is right.
But I think for Lance's question, it's important to point out that you can assume that Eve has complete access to the quantum tunnel. She can intercept, she can change whatever. The man in the middle attack refers to where she also does that for the classical tunnel.
Oh, I see.
So he could be against two tunnels, and she can do whatever she likes.
Right,
but the assumption
right.
under which QPD is secure is that she can't intercept and pretend to be the other party on the classical channel.
And then I think when Alice and Bob come together, they would know that some of the ideas are mutual.
I mean, they need this authentication so that they know that the classical communication is between Alice and Bob. Like, there's not an assumption that they come together at some
But isn't the point that the classical communication isn't necessarily secure?
The classical communication doesn't have to be secure. It can be eavesdropped. But there has to be authentication.
So it's you allow Eve to learn everything about your classical signals. Problem is if Eve was the one sending the signals. So rather than Bob sending the signal to Alice, it was Eve who sent the signal to Alice. That would be a problem. But as long as Alice and Bob share some prior secret key, then Alice can say, prove to me, you know, this person who's communicating classically with me, prove to me you're Bob by telling me, you know, the 17th digit of our secret key. That's something the eavesdropper would not be able to do.
That's how encryption is now. You need some way of getting the key across. Because, like, when you go to, like, an HTTPS website, if somebody is sniffing the connection when you exchange your key, they can still watch what you're doing. It's only if you already have the secure connection. But what will happen is if they try to do that, your browser will tell you that the certificate you're being authored by the man in the middle attack isn't a proper one, but usually people just click and dig through that.
Yeah, someday in the future we'll have quantum security and people just like, you know, no, your line is not secure, okay. I don't care. All right. Let me, in the last bit, just get started on talking about contextuality. And so again, here I'm going to start by just trying to give you an intuitive feel for what contextuality is. And then next lecture, and probably some of the lecture after that, we'll go into more of the details. So I'm going to do it using an example that was presented by Ernst Becker in 1960. So contextuality sometimes goes by the name of the Cochin-Specker theorem. And it was discovered by Bell working with a result that was proved by Gleason. So Gleason's result was from 1957. Bell's result was from 64. But it was also proved independently by Cochin and Specker in 1967. But if you look at some of Specker's earlier papers, he already sort of understood what was going on back in 1960. So in this paper, for example, he says, it is trivial to show that this works for quantum mechanics, but he doesn't bother to give an explicit construction. But this is a really interesting paper. He was actually thinking about counterfactuals, so you know, propositions like if it was the case that X, then it would be the case that Y. And in quantum mechanics, where you have complementarity, you know, two measurements that you can't do simultaneously, then that question naturally arises. You know, so I actually measured A, but had I measured B, you know, what outcome would I have gotten? And he was interested in whether you can actually talk about the truth of counterfactual propositions in quantum mechanics. Can you assign truth values to these measurements? Statements about outcomes of measurements you didn't do. And so there was a tradition of that in theology. People talked about whether God could know the truth of counterfactuals. That was called infuturabilities. So Specker was actually thinking, I think he wrote a few things about the connections or that sort of motivation for these sorts of questions. You know, could God know the outcome of experiments that weren't done quantum mechanically? You know, does it make sense to talk about the truth values of those things? So in this paper, he gave a really simple example wherein you would have these three boxes. And he has a whole story to go along with it, but I don't have time to tell you the story. But the bottom line is that this three-box system has this interesting property that every box either, you know, has a gem in it or it doesn't. And when you open two of the boxes, you always see that there's a gem in one and no gem in the other. So you always get anti-correlated outcomes. And you can't open all three boxes simultaneously. You can only open pairs of boxes simultaneously. But you always see this anti-correlation. And yet, how could that be? If there really was some assignment of gems to the boxes, how could it be that no matter which two I open, I always see anti-correlated outcomes? There should be some pair which would either both be full or both be empty. But you would never find any kind of contradiction because you can never open all three at once. So the idea is that, you know, you can imagine that there are three measurements, each of which have two outcomes, and you can't measure the three simultaneously. You can only measure pairs of them simultaneously, right? So this one and this one, or this one and this one, or this one and this one. And you can imagine that there's a preparation of the system such that the outcomes always disagree. Whichever pair you measure, you always get outcomes that disagree. So if you, say, get the green outcome here, then you have to get the red outcome here. Now, if you measure these two guys together, then it's red and green. I guess that shouldn't be here on this one because you can't measure all three at the same time. And similarly, if I imagine that there's some ontic state, some hidden variables that simultaneously fix the outcomes of all these guys, then it would have to specify an outcome for each one of them. So it might say, okay, it's definitely going to be green for yellow, and it's definitely going to be red over here and green over here, but then it doesn't satisfy this correlation. So, you know, imagining that there's these hidden variables that specify the outcomes is inconsistent with the observed correlations in this case. And the critical assumption is that the outcome you get for this first measurement here should be the same regardless of whether you measure it together with M3 or together with M2. That's the assumption. If the outcome was allowed to depend which one you were doing it with, then you could get disagreement on both sides. So that is what is called the assumption of non-contextuality. So if the outcomes are fixed deterministically by the ontic state, physical state of the system, and the outcomes are independent to the context, they're independent of what you're measuring, say, if you're doing M1, whether you're measuring it with M2 or M3, then it would have to be that you could only see anti-correlation two-thirds of the time. That's clear. And so if you lived in a world where you did this sort of experiment and you found that you got anti-correlation more than two-thirds of the time, you wouldn't be able to think of what was going on as there being some ontic state that deterministically set the outcomes independently of the context. So you might say what fails is this assumption of context independence, that we must have some context dependence if we want this kind of realist model. So that's the simplest example I know of this phenomena of contextuality. Now, the unfortunate thing is that this example doesn't work in quantum theory. I can't give you a quantum example that violates this inequality. Can anyone see why? This is a very tricky question, but I just want to put it out there in case anyone sees the reason. If we have three different systems, then we can, you know, measure all three of them simultaneously. But you might say, what if I just had one system, you know, one d-dimensional system, and these are just different measurements on that same single d-dimensional system. And, you know, just as in quantum mechanics, you know, there are certain pairs of information operators that commute that I can measure jointly, other pairs of information operators that don't commute that I can't measure jointly. I would say, all right, well, we just find some triple of measurements such that, you know, I can measure all these pairs simultaneously, but I can't measure all three simultaneously.
If each pair of them would come here, then one with a pair of them. So we can't do simultaneously.
Yes, that's the answer, right. That if I tell you here are three projective measurements, the first commutes with the second commutes with the third, and the first commutes with the third, it follows that they are all simultaneously diagonalizable, and therefore you can measure all three of them simultaneously. So what Specker was imagining here was a kind of complementarity, which you can conceive of, but which doesn't arise in quantum mechanics. A triple of measurements such that you can implement any pair of them jointly, but you can't measure all three of them jointly. We don't see that kind of complementarity in quantum mechanics, so we can't get this sort of effect. But Specker was saying you could imagine a theory wherein this was true. And it is the simplest example. All right, I'm gonna go over just a few minutes again, but we're almost done. If you have any frustrated network, you can build up one of these kinds of inequalities for a non-contextual realist model. So suppose I draw a network where the nodes are binary variables. The edges imply the possibility of joint measurability. So these are really the binary variables are the outcomes of measurements. An edge between the nodes means I can measure those two things jointly. And a straight edge is going to mean that the outcomes agree, i.e. perfect correlation. A dashed edge will mean that the outcomes disagree, perfect anticorrelation. And frustration means that there's no set of values that you can assign to the nodes that satisfy all the constraints, all the correlations. Like here's the example we just saw where we demand anticorrelation. And if I try to assign zeros and ones to these nodes, I could put zero here, one here, zero here, but then I have correlation, so I can't satisfy all that. So this comes up in condensed matter physics when you talk about Hamiltonians that want spins to be aligned or anti-aligned. You can get frustrated networks. So first of all, note that these are all frustrated networks, right? If these guys agree, then they should agree on the third line and so on. But actually, they're not really different because if I just change the labeling of one node, right? So if this is switched from 0 to 1, then if it was anti-correlated with these guys, it becomes correlated with these guys. So swapping the label here takes me to this one here. So these are all equivalent up to relabeling of the outcome. So it's really the same frustrated network. So if you say, all right, well, what's the next most complicated frustrated network? It's the square. So I could take, for example, this guy here, which is agreement across all these edges, disagreement across this edge. That'll also be frustrated, because all of these agreements imply that I should have agreement here. And all these other guys are just relabelings of this. Okay, so what it means is if I want to construct an example out of him, I could say imagine four measurements such that I have the outcomes agreeing whenever I measure those sorts of pairs simultaneously, and the outcomes disagreeing if I measure one of the pairs simultaneously. Of course, this pair and this pair cannot be measured simultaneously. So there's a kind of complementarity here. We're saying that M2 and M4 can't be measured simultaneously. Neither can M1 and M3. And so then you could, again, say, if the outcomes are fixed deterministically by the ontic state and are independent of the context, well, then at most, the probability of generating these correlations could be 3/4, because I'll have values assigned to all of those guys. And clearly, one of those links will have to fail. So what does this look like? It's exactly, it looks like what we talked about last time, right? If I just swap these bottom two guys, and I say, OK, M3 is now over here on the left with M1, and M4 is over here on the right with M2. Well, if these are two different measurements, like spin Z and spin X, then I can't measure them simultaneously. Similarly over here, if they're two non-orthogonal bases, I can't measure them simultaneously. But of course, I can measure this guy together with this, or this guy together with that, and so on. And I can ask, is there a quantum state and a set of observables such that I can violate this inequality? It still holds here. And of course, that's exactly what Bell's theorem shows. So one way to think about it is that local determinism, where you say the outcome I get over here should not depend on whether I've measured this or measured that in the space like separated region, that's a kind of context independence. So the contextuality is about saying this outcome here doesn't depend on what I'm measuring it together with in general. I don't need to further justify that by saying that that choice is made far away. The proofs of non-locality are kind of in a stronger position than proofs of contextuality, because they say, even if you demand that the independence of the outcome here on the choice here is justified by this being far away, you can still get a contradiction. So there's this tight connection between non-locality and contextuality, just having to do with whether the context on which you're assuming things are independent is something that's, you know, nearby or very far away at a space-like separated distance. We'll say more about this connection when we go into the more details. So let me end with this other example, which is just the next step up, a frustrated network of 5 nodes with anti-correlation between all the pairs. Clearly, at best, you can get anti-correlation 4/5 of the time because you know, if I have anti-correlation across these even numbers, then I should have correlation across one of them. And therefore, you know, at most, I'll have 4/5 of the correlation satisfied. And so you could again ask, is there a quantum example of this? And there is. You can find 5 projective measurements such that each one commutes with the next one. So Li plus 1 mod 5 is equal to 0. So that means, you know, these can be measured simultaneously, these two can be measured simultaneously, and so on. So I have this sort of pattern of joint measurability. I can't measure any other pair of them jointly. And I can show that the probability of success is greater than 4/5. So here's the example. So first of all, let me just redraw this as a star, just for simplicity, right? I haven't changed anything by just changing where the nodes are on the page. And now let me show you what these 5 vectors look like that have that notion of orthogonality. So here's the origin. I'm imagining a 3-dimensional Hilbert space. I'm going to draw it as a real 3-dimensional Hilbert space. I don't need any complex amplitudes for this example. So here's a vector L1. Here's vector L2. They're separated by 90 degrees. That's what this tells me I can do. And L2 and L3, similarly, L3 and L4, L3 and L5. To convince you that I can find 5 such vectors, it's pretty simple. You know, imagine I have my vectors. The origin is in the plane where these points are, so that the vectors are just pointing out all in a plane. Well, then the angle between 2 of these guys is greater than 90 degrees. It's almost 180 here. And if I lift up those vectors and bring them up towards the North Pole, then the angle between 2 of them goes to 0. So somewhere in that lifting process, that angle is going to hit 90 degrees. And by symmetry, it's going to be a 90 degree separation for any pair that are connected in this star. OK? And then you can just derive that the angle at which that happens is when each one of these vectors makes an angle theta with the center point. Cos squared theta is 1 over root 5. Okay, so now here's let's show that we have a violation. This, by the way, is an example due to the mathematician Kliachko from very recently. What you do is you prepare the state psi, which is on that symmetry axis, and then you imagine doing these measurements. And the question is, how often of the time do I get anti-correlated outcomes? Okay, so let's focus on this case, L1, L2. And of course, there's a third vector that's perpendicular to L1 and L2. That's a basis. So suppose I do that measurement when the preparation is state psi. All right, so let's drop everything else just for clarity. And I ask, what's the probability of getting this set of outcomes? You know, 1 for L1, 0, and 0 for the other 2 vectors. So if there really is a hidden variable model, then the hidden variables will say sometimes that's the values I should assign to these guys. Sometimes it's these values. Sometimes it's these values. And to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics, I need to say that I get these values 1 over root 5 at the time, because that's the overlap of psi with L1. Quantum mechanics says when I do this measurement for this state, I get this outcome this much of the time. So I'd better have these values assigned to those guys by the hidden variables this amount of the time. Similarly for these guys, they should be assigned this amount of the time. And then these guys just take up the difference. But it's only these 2 which have anti-correlation, right? 1, 0, and 0, 1. If I got this outcome, it would be correlation for L1 and L2. So the total probability of these anti-correlations is 2 over root 5. And that's true for all the pairs by symmetry. And then if you just work out what 2 root over root 5 is, it's 0.89, which is greater than 4/5. And so you have anti-correlation more than 4/5 of the time in this example. Anyhow, so that's sort of a brief overview of how contextuality works to give you a feel for it. But we're going to go into it in more depth next time, and I'll answer all your questions about it then.